Hey folks, Professor here, just giving you a little heads up. We're going deep dive into Black Panther this week. If you haven't seen the movie yet, we do have a couple of spoilers here and there, so if you want to wait till you've seen the movie, please give us a chance later. But you've been warned, don't dive in if you haven't seen it yet, because we do spoil quite a bit. Hope you enjoy.
Hey folks, welcome to the Boss's Desk, where we look out for you, giving you the best in geek news and movie reviews. We'll switch up this week. This is the Professor, and I'll be your host, getting in as much time as I can before turning over to the reins to the future king of Wakanda, the Big Boss. What's going on, Boss?
Hey, what's going on? What's going on? Wakanda forever, my people.
So we're going to do a little bit different this week. We're not going to give you our total normal podcast because of the big movie over the weekend. We're just going to focus on Black Panther. Go figure. So considering that I probably won't have a whole lot to say outside of my man here, figured we'd let me get my time in ahead of time. So we've both seen the movie. I saw it only once, unfortunately. I wanted to see it more than once. I did not get the opportunity. The Boss has seen it, what, four times now?
Three times. I'm trying to see it again tomorrow, but yeah, I'll be seeing it. I'll be seeing it a couple more times.
I am definitely going at least one more time this weekend. I definitely need to get it in so I can kind of determine where it lies for me in the grand scheme of things as far as like a top 10, which, you know, it's almost impossible now to rank these Marvel movies beyond this is my favorite, here's everything else.
Right.
But yeah, I'll get my time in. You'll probably see it 17 more times before I get to see it that. Which is fine. It deserves every bit of money that we're giving to it. So
exactly.
Why don't we just get right into it? You know, let's say what we thought. I'll let you start there. I'll give my feelings, and then we'll kind of get into more specifics of what we like. So why don't you go ahead and start us off there?
All right. Sounds good. So yeah, man. I mean, I really like this film. It's definitely one of my favorites. I'm gonna. Right now, I just say that I put it on the same level with Captain America Winter Soldier, and we'll probably talk about that a little later, but I really want to just dive into this film. So first things first, we both talked before we even started the podcast, like the script, the writing of this film is definitely on my tops, like why I like this film. The way that they... The messages that they had, the little subtle messages that they had, the jokes that they had scattered throughout, just the personalities that they captured through every line that was spoken. It's a self-contained film. Like I loved that aspect. Like you start off this film with basically a conversation between father and son. I'm still trying to figure out which father and son it is. Because I can't remember if the kid had an accent, so I was thinking that it might have been Killmonger and his dad.
That's interesting. I didn't even pick that up.
Yeah, because I kind of felt like maybe it was him trying to keep the idea of Wakanda alive and fresh within his line because he was on assignment, so he wasn't going to be able to do this. Either that or it's T'Chaka and T'Challa, but I love the way that it starts. It gives you a self-contained anthology of Wakandan history in a minute or two, and gives you everything spelled out, what makes Wakanda the nation that it is, the technologically advanced nation that it is, why there is a Black Panther that is the protector of Wakanda, and it gives you just how all the tribes came together, why the Jabari clan is in the mountains. It just really does a good job of telling you this story so that you wouldn't even have to go back and look at other comics or look at other Marvel films. You know exactly where this sits. It's basically sitting right after Civil War. You see the images of T'Chaka getting killed and how it affects T'Challa. And it's basically just picking up as soon as T'Challa comes home.
Yeah,
and
so it's like days after, more or less.
Yeah. So I loved how they did it. Like they did it in a way where you get a feel for these characters, you get a feel for the story, you get a feel for the world, and you don't have to go looking elsewhere to get that information. You can get it all in this film. So just coming off the street, having never watched a Marvel film at all, you will definitely enjoy yourself with the way that they wrote this film, and I love that.
You essentially get an origin story in the first 5 minutes of the film without even really having to go deep into the origin of the whole setup. You really learn
right.
everything about it. I do think, though, I'm leaning towards thinking it's T'Challa and T'Chaka, because don't they say in the movie that Killmonger was born in the United States?
Yeah, he was born in the United States. So I was just, I always wondered if it was N'Jobu telling his son, because it, even though his son had never been to Wakanda, his father was trying to teach him that it was home. But that's I don't know. It may not be, because, you know, Eric basically finds this information out eventually.
Right.
And they show that in a flashback, or they show that in a, like, an ancestral plane scene. You know what I'm saying? So it could be either or, but I love that it started off that like that. It gave me Assassin's Creed vibes, origins.
I can see that. Okay.
Yeah.
That.
Like him talking to his son and telling the stories and of the culture and the past and the gods that they worship in Egypt. You know what I'm saying? Like, it gave me that feel, that oral tradition of history that is like very quintessential African culture, old African customs, like handing that history down word of mouth
yep.
from generation to generation. I love that.
It was really well done. I like that part too.
Yeah, man. What else did I like about this, John? Ah, the visuals. So much color, so much vivid imagery. Just the beauty and the majesty of Wakanda, like looking at this world, this technological pearl wrapped in nature, was just that was beautiful. You know what I'm saying? One of my favorite scenes is the ritual combat scene where they all come together, and basically it's like a formality at first for T'Challa to take the throne. Anybody who wants to go for the throne, they can test T'Challa and beat him in this combat. And if they beat him, then they can take the throne and they can become Black Panther. But it was just like that scene. He comes off of the plane, he comes off of the jet, and he's walking into this pond within this waterfall, and you look up and there's all these colors and all these different varieties of Black folk just all just sitting there just watching him. It's a powerful moment, man. And I love that. Yeah, man. It was just like the visuals in this movie, the costumes, the just the different colors. I loved it.
The time they spent in putting, like you just said, the costuming together and going for kind of that, it's going to sound odd to say tribal accuracy, but it's really kind of what it is. Even though it's technically a fake, you know, set of tribes, you really do get the feeling like these could potentially really exist somewhere.
Exactly.
Just because
of
the look everything has, and, you know, the ritual scarring some of them take on, and the one tribesman has the piece in his lip.
I think it was the River Tribe guy.
River Trap guy, that always freaks me out when I see that, but he has that, the lip plate, I guess is what it is, essentially, right?
Yeah.
They really give you a lot of that ancient African tribe, along with that mysticism, all surrounded and kind of encompassed by this cutting-edge technology that's better than anything else in the entire world.
Yeah.
You know, and just the way that it all weaves together, like we were talking about before we started, how they show you intro, you know, they show you, obviously, if you know the story, you know Wakanda is kind of a hidden tribe. They kind of want to stay hidden from the rest of the world.
Right.
To keep their people protected and to keep their technologies protected, because what they have could cause massive world wars.
Yeah.
Just because of how advanced they really are. So the outside is what you would see as a stereotypical African tribe, you know, kind of a, not run down, but it's, you know, it's a lot of dirt, it's a lot of adobe, a lot of farm animals, a lot of farming, you know, kind of what you would expect almost an African tribe to look like.
Yeah.
And then they go through that visual shield, that thing that's cutting them off from the rest of the world, and it's still essentially the same thing at heart, but it's excuse me, but it's got this massive technological upgrade to it that just brings the whole city to life in a way that you don't see in those outside areas because of the nature of what goes on outside. Mm-hmm. It just adds this whole second life to these people, and it's just amazing to watch.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, with these special cars and the special train systems and the rail systems and everything that they've got that's not seen anywhere else in the world. Yeah. Except this one little bubble that really nobody knows exists.
Yeah.
It's just an amazing, and you really kind of have that feeling when you're in there that they're happy people. Like, there's nothing really going on there that upsets these people. You know what I mean? They're all happy to kind of be in the culture that they're in and inside, hidden away from the world, protected. And it just, you really start to feel, you know, and I'll say it as an odd way, it'll sound weird, but even as a white person, you know, I felt like part of this tribe, watching them walk around and
interact
with each other and kind of seeing what's going on there. It's really kind of an amazing way to pull you in.
Yeah,
it's really spectacular.
Yeah, I think that was like one of the strengths of this movie is that it made the attempt by the end of the film to make everybody sitting in the audience to feel like a member of Wakanda. It wanted you to be involved. It wanted you to take participation in this world that we're. It feels homey, as you're watching this film and as you're watching these environments. You know what I'm saying? We're talking about visuals, but like we can even go even into the sounds of it, just the soundtrack, and you know how majestic Wakanda feels once you break past that barrier. Just the music that they play that, you know, symbolizes Wakanda, T'Challa, and this whole world that we're in. It's really powerful, and it's a useful tool that I feel like that allows the audience to kind of assimilate into this world that they're stepping into. It was really great. The soundtrack from start to finish in that movie was like simply one of the best. Normally buy scores and soundtracks the same. I either get a soundtrack music inspired by the film, or I get the score music from the film. For me, I got both. I got the Kendrick Lamar official soundtrack, which some of the songs are featured. They have like the end credit song, Casino. All that music from there. Then the soundtrack has like when you enter in Wakanda, when you meet Eric Killmonger for the first time, like his theme music is probably like second to the Wakanda theme music. It's Eric Killmonger's theme music is incredible. Like the bass is just like you feel it. Like you know like what's going on is serious right now. And with Eric Killmonger, there comes a lot of weight, and you feel that in the beat of that song, of his theme song. And it's great watching those, that mixed with the visuals and like even something as subtle as like the changing of the rule. Like when Killmonger takes over, like he walks into the throne room and there's different visuals than when T'Challa walked into the throne room.
Yeah.
It's like you watched Eric Killmonger kind of flip everything upside down. And so it just kind of starts from upside down and then comes into the right way. Like everything's not going to be the same anymore in Wakanda. Like it's just, I love the way that they do that stuff. Those subtle hints and those subtle notes to make you feel that things are different or things are changing, or this scene has weight and that scene is a little lighter. You know what I'm saying? Like, I love that. I love that, man.
And Marvel's got a history of kind of doing little things like that, mm-hmm, in certain places. Like, if you go back and watch The Defenders, mm-hmm, one of the things that I didn't really know about, didn't pick up on until somebody told me about it, is when you see the characters individually by themselves, there's a lot of their colors around.
Yeah.
Them. Like, when it's just Matt Murdock, it's a lot of red. When it's just Luke, it's a lot of yellow. When it's just the Iron Fist, it's a lot of green. When it's just Jessica Jones, it's a lot of purple.
Yeah.
So Marvel in general usually does a pretty good job of doing little things like that. But there's just something different about the way it was done in Black Panther that, you know, you really kind of felt like Coogler must have spent a lot of time somewhere studying the different things that these different, like actual tribes and things do, and the interaction between the tribes and the, you know, their systems of government almost between them all, you know, because there's a lot of what feels to me, now, look, I don't have a whole lot of knowledge on it, but there's a lot of what feels to be pretty accurate. It gives you that feeling of what you would expect to see in that kind of setup. So, it's awesome to watch that kind of stuff, and especially, like you said, the music themes, you know, and again, they're always been really good with that in certain movies, you know. If Captain America does something heroic, you hear his theme play real gently kind of behind him. You know, in Ragnarok, where I think is when Thor and Hulk are arguing with each other, there's a real mild version of the Lonely Man theme playing behind the Hulk as he's talking. Yeah. You know, just the little touches like that are amazing. But in Black Panther, it was like they turned it up to 11 for a lot of that stuff when it went through. So, you know, I'm looking forward to watching again to try to catch more of that. Because, you know, the first time through you're watching it to try to catch the movie itself. You're not really looking for too much of that in-depth stuff. But you do pick out little pieces here and there of things like that. And it really is impressive the way it was done for this movie.
Definitely. Even if we dive deeper into the visuals, let's talk about the action a little bit. Like some of the fighting scenes, the choreographed scenes, some of the just exchanges between Eric and T'Challa throughout the film. Like the fighting was so on point for me. We were talking about the ritual combat scene before, and watching T'Challa take on M'Baku, like his fighting, you could definitely tell that there are different styles that T'Challa is well learned in the martial arts, but there's like a heavy inspiration from the comics. So in the comics, T'Challa is like, he's a big fan of Bruce Lee. He's always been a big fan of Bruce Lee. So you can see that confidence and that almost borderline arrogance in his fighting style. But then with that, you see traditional African fighting styles. But one of the ones that stood out the most to me was the capoeira that he uses to pretty much take down M'Baku at the end. He does this crazy, like, flip headlock, arm lock move at the end of their battle.
Yeah.
And locks him. It was incredible, man. Like, that was probably, like, the greatest move I think I saw in that film, other than the end scene where he finally ends it with Eric Killmonger. Like, yo, man, it was really, really good. Really well done.
Even more in that scene, what kind of strikes me is, so you've got T'Challa, who is basically the representation of the Black Panther. He is the Black Panther, but in the fight, he's the representation of the Black Panther. And here comes M'Baku and his tribe, who are essentially followers, you would say, of the apes or gorillas.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of their spirit animal.
Yeah.
M'Baku comes through with the big, that was, we were talking offline, one of my favorite parts of the movie is how they envisioned him for this movie. Because if you know the M'Baku character from the comics, it is a large man who is basically wearing the skin of a gorilla. Yeah. It's a white gorilla outfit, and he looks ridiculous. It would never have flown in the movie. It would
not
have just been
all
considered racist. It would have been just, it would have not, it sort of looked awful.
Yeah.
So what they do to turn it around is they give him just a little bit of tuft, like a little almost cape, kind of goes across his shoulder, and this ornate, awesome wooden ape mask that he wears. Yeah. And as you're watching the fight, you kind of feel almost like it's an ape fighting a panther. Just their styles that they're using.
Yep.
You know, M'Baku's attacks are these strong, powerful overhead attacks or strong backhand swings.
Yeah.
You know, things that you would, like a fight you would expect to see an ape kind of fight one-on-one.
Yeah.
Whereas T'Challa is moving quickly. He's trying to duck under and get around and move really fast like a panther would do. And just that feel of that fight as it's going on is just amazing.
Yeah.
Because you really kind of feel like you're watching these two totems of these two animals going at it. You know, it's awesome. It's just so well done with the, that particular fight in general. Just so well done that way.
Yeah, man. Yeah, it was really good. It's like I like that they take their time and they focus on, you know, how we can make this symbolic but like elemental and just really carry out the personalities of these characters in their fighting style and things like that. It's just right. Like watching T'Challa move around throughout the rest of the movie, just when he gets suited up and just how he like moves through the scene, like he's quick, like the way that he thinks, it's like, oh, it spurred him, like I gotta be able to change up my styles or change my direction. It's so very reminiscent of the agility of a big cat like that.
Yep,
you know what
absolutely.
I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I loved that. Like the way he moved, how he moved through scenes, like it was really good. Like even just the playful nature of the way that he fought in certain scenes. It was really cool that they could incorporate a lot of that stuff in there, man.
Yeah, I don't know who they used to choreograph their fight scenes, but they need that guy on season 2 of Iron Fist.
definitely.
I think they could learn a lot about that with that guy, because he really knew what he was doing when he put those fights together. Whoever their choreograph setup was awesome. Excellent.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of these characters, because then I definitely want to dive into some of the lines and the themes that I kind of got from the film. But it's just like let's dive into these characters, because there's fan favorites, there's the baddest of the bad, and then there's the complicated characters. I loved it. So first up, let's talk about Wakabi. Wakabi is like T'Challa's secondhand man in right. this film. What I like about what they did, and I know that we sort of disagree on this, so I want you to talk about like what you feel about Wakabi. But I feel like they did a good enough job of setting up this kind of tension that Wakabi was having with the current style of government that was happening. You know what I'm saying? Like we get introduced to him early on in the film, they come back. T'Challa gets his rightful place as King of Wakanda, and you know, he's kind of walking around talking to some of his friends. And I think he was doing it in response to something that his father said about getting people around him that he could trust. So he's like talking to Wakabi. He's feeding these huge rhinos that I guess his particular tribe is like taking care of and cultivating.
Right.
And you know, Wakabi's asking him, first he's asking about Nakia, like, are you guys gonna get back together? Da 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 da. But he, like, T'Challa says, you know, Nakia's got me thinking about some things. You know, just the way that we do things here. She thinks that maybe we should do more outreach. We should start bringing more refugees in, and we should start sharing our technology, our knowledge, our wealth with outsiders, basically. And you know, for the most part, Wakanda has been very closed off and isolated for years. They've been doing this for years. That's why they hide behind this dome shield.
Right.
And she's like, you know, she feels like we could do more if we help other people. And Wakabi has this line that kind of like shakes, like I feel like depending on the audience, it was dependent on the night. I think Saturday was like prime time for everybody, so it was like the most packed audience, most wide range of audience members. And he says this line. He's like, "Oh man, you know," it's like, "I don't know, man. We start bringing in refugees. You know, they bring their problems with them, and if they bring their problems with them, we'll just end up like everybody." Every other nation. And it's so crazy because you hear that. That's basically, you know, the sentiment today is like, you know, at least with this current administration, is like how we should close our borders off. You know right. what I'm saying? So it's like, that's kind of like the start for me as to where I'm like, I don't know about this guy Wakabi. He's like too cut off. He wants to be too isolated. It feels kind of elitist. So it's like as you dig further into his conversations with T'Challa, he has another moment where he's like, I thought you were going to do something different for me, different than your father. And it just sounds like it's more of the same. And it's like, yo, you're just hearing a lot of things that we're familiar with even today. You know what I'm saying? And it's like Wakabi's restlessness with the current state of affairs in Wakanda kind of, it just, those little breadcrumbs lead me to understand, like, okay, when he makes this shift, I'm not going to be surprised, because he's been kind of setting up for this. He's been looking for some kind of drastic change, and Killmonger was that change for him. So it's like, I don't think he was so much loyal to Killmonger, but it was like, it was interesting to watch how he represents one school of thought in Wakanda, which is like, I want to say ultra xenophobic, ultra isolation. Nobody should be involved with Wakanda, but if we're going to be involved in the world, then we go out there and we tell them what to do. You know what I'm saying? We shape the world and we make it the way that we want it to be. And it's like, I mean, like, that's a dangerous mindset to have.
Yeah.
Especially when you're dealing with government. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, it's just like watching Wakabi's character and the conversation that he was having with T'Challa. It's like, by the time you get to the end of his arc, you kind of understand why he makes that change, because he's been dropping subtle hints all movie, you know? So it's just like, it's crazy to see that, because Wakabi in the comics was always T'Challa's right-hand man. So right. It's like, yo, man, this is this guy even going to be in the next one? Because he's like, he basically commits treason by the end of the film. And it's like,
there's no basically about it. He does. Yeah. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah. So it's like, sheesh, like, man, like, this is not the Wakabi I grew up with. Like, what happened?
That's what T'Challa was saying.
Yeah. Exactly, man. So it was crazy. Like, Wakabi was an interesting character because of that school of thought that he represents. Right. And like, each of these characters have like a certain school of thought that they represent, and it's so interesting to see how they interact with each other in high octane moments. You know what I'm saying? So,
and the pain that it causes some of them to have to stick to their morals.
Yeah,
you know, particularly like the head of the Dora Milaje, you know, she has probably the hardest moment. You know, not to skip ahead to her, but since we're talking about that,
yeah,
you know, she has absolutely the hardest moment in the entire movie,
right?
Because she's now torn. So obviously, spoilers. If you haven't seen the movie yet, we're going to be spoiling things left and right. We've already done it. We're going to keep doing it. So if you've listened this far and you haven't seen the movie, well, I don't know what to tell you. We apologize. We spoiled something for you. We're going to keep going, so turn it off now. Ready?
We're in it.
3, 2, 1. All right, you had your chance. So, you know, she has what I felt was the hardest moment in the entire movie. Very clearly does not like Killmonger. But Killmonger tops T'Challa in battle. They assume T'Challa is dead. So he is now the rightful king and the rightful Black Panther. She is sworn as the head of the Dora Milaje to follow the Black Panther, to follow the King of Wakanda. Mm-hmm. And that's what she has to do. You know, at one point, is it Nadia or Nakia, the girlfriend?
Mm-hmm. Nakia.
Nakia, thank you. I couldn't remember exactly which one. Nakia comes to her and says, we got to get out of here. We got to protect Shuri and T'Challa's mother. We got to get them out of here. And Okoye goes, I can't. I have to stay here. I'm loyal to the king. Whether I like him or not, I have to stay here.
Yeah,
and just the pain on her face when she has to say that to Nakia, you can tell it's tearing her to pieces. But she knows what she has to do. She has to stay with the king. That's where her place is.
Yep,
you know. And she, you find out in the movie, she is the mate for. I'm awful with names. It's been that kind of week.
The guy you were talking about. She's with Wakabi.
Wakabi, thank you.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, and Wakabi has made that turn. My issues with Wakabi was I thought the turn was a little too quick. Mm-hmm. Now, again, I need to see it again to kind of catch some of the stuff that you were talking about, because I missed some of that. But I just thought, you know, at one moment, he and T'Challa are outside. They're joking. They're having a good time talking with each other. They're best friends ever. He comes to see T'Challa to find out that Claw's gotten away from them. And he immediately turns his back on T'Challa. Not like, you know, hey, I'll give you one more shot. It was just you're just as bad as your dad. Turns around and walks away from him. Like,
it just seemed to me like too much of a quick twist. Now, considering how strong every character in the movie is, calling him the weakest character, in my opinion, isn't really that big a deal.
Right, right, right.
You know, because he's still a very strong character and still a really important character in the film.
Right.
You know, who he, at the end, you know, turns on everybody, including Okoye, because he believes Killmonger's right. At that point, he believes they should be going out and helping every other, you know, underprivileged, you know, group of people in the world to overthrow governments so that Wakanda can basically be the power of the entire world.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just, it's interesting to see him make that switch, you know. But, I mean, that, and again, to me, I thought he was the weakest character in the movie, but he was still really strong in a really important role. So,
yeah.
You know, to say that is kind of harsh, but look, in a movie full of the characters that are in that movie, it's relatively hard to speaking. Not. Yeah, relatively speaking. You know, it's not a bad thing, you know, as far as he's concerned. So,
yeah.
But you know, and I'll leave it up to if you want to, you know, if you want to delve into her next. I think, you know, Okoye potentially is the strongest character in the movie. Like I said, because she has to make that difficult change, and because she's so tied to following, you know, the ways that she doesn't feel like she has any other option.
Yeah.
Until that absolute moment where she realizes that, you know, he's not really the true king. He's not doing kingly things. T'Challa's still alive. All right, guess what? We're turning this around. You know, and takes on Killmonger, which is, that also is an amazing scene to watch.
Yeah. Because she knows exactly what she has to do and what has to be done in that moment. And it's like, I wouldn't so much say I feel like Okoye is the strongest character. I feel like she's definitely the most resolved. Like, she knows, she is very loyal to her duties, and this is the other school of thought. I feel like in Wakanda there's this Wakandan loyalist mindset that Okoye represents. Like, she's like, I'm loyal to the throne and the throne alone. I do have my loves and my cares, but the throne comes first. My state, my country comes first. That patriotism, and it's like we've seen that. We've seen that even in America. You know what I'm saying? Like that mindset, that just dead set on patriotism. It's beautiful. It really is. Fundamentally, it's beautiful when we know that the rules can be followed, and that in their development they are perfect. But it's like, we live in a world where we understand, like, laws, government, they're far from it. So it's like the loyalty to the throne can end up shooting you in the foot, because you look at Okoye by the end of the movie, she loses so much. You know what I'm saying? She loses so much at first. You know what I'm saying? Because when you look at it, she's loyal to the throne, so she loses the king that she really admired and respects. She knows she'll be at a distance from her friends, and she knows that her loyalty to the throne is also now creating a rift between her and her significant other.
Right.
So it's like she's seeing this guy in a whole nother light now. It's like, oh, masks are completely off now. I'm seeing you for who you actually are now, and you like this. You're fine with this. You're fine with this military insertion. And he's like, he makes that statement. He's like, eventually it's going to become the conquered and the conquerors, and I'd rather be the latter. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, that's the way she looks at him, you can see, like, now the veil has been lifted. Like, she doesn't see Wakabi the same way anymore. And it's like, she gets a moment of relief when T'Challa comes back and they realize that the combat is still open, so they need to do this.
Right.
But then when she sees Killmonger order Wakabi and his men to go after Black Panther, it's like, she's like, yo, all you care about, like, now it's not even about the throne. It's not even about Wakanda. It's not even about ruling. You just want to see everything burn.
Right.
And in that, you want to see Wakanda burn. This is a problem. And her loyalty to Wakanda will not allow her to be no longer be loyal to Killmonger, which which I agree with you. She has one of the most powerful scenes in the film where she turns to Killmonger and says, all right, enough is enough. And she takes him on. It wasn't even like, it wasn't T'Challa who took him on first. It was Okoye who went after him. It's like, and this is just a bigger, this is just a bigger statement than in this movie. The women in this film, I feel take the forefront in this film, and I love it. I love that they're not like they're not getting pushed to the side. They're not getting regulated to minor sub characters. Like, these are characters that are very involved in the development of these stories, and it's like Okoye took it on herself to say, "Look, it's time to get our country back," and I loved that.
It was great.
It was great. And she, I mean, her squad was just, they were on it. They were on it. Like, they follow her orders. She says, hey, yo, go help T'Challa. And then she has the other four that are with her, and they're all just synced up perfectly. Like, she is indeed a general. And you know this.
Yep.
Through that scene.
Another beautifully choreographed fight scene with them just kind of flipping around together, moving as one.
Yeah.
Almost like a Roman army, like Spartans. They're just in sync with each other. They're right on top of each other, and they're just putting him through the paces. You know, it's just amazing to watch that scene. It's one of my favorite scenes.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Oh, man. So, yeah, Okoye is definitely a strong character, or at least a strength in her resolve, I feel like. If we want to talk about the other schools of thought that I see, that Shuri, Nakia, and Killmonger, they demonstrate the other schools of thought, and T'Challa is kind of like he leans more towards Nakia, so he's the one that's viewing these schools of thoughts and trying to figure out which one he's going to use as the king of Wakanda. But if we talk about we'll talk about Nakia next. Nakia is basically, she's a part of the War Dogs. Traditionally in the comics, they were a group that T'Challa would send out to spy on other nations, and they were called the Hatut Zarazi, and they were like his dogs of war. They traditionally wore the white, it was like the white Black Panther suits with the stealth technology, vibranium weave, and all of that. The only difference between them and T'Challa is that they didn't take the heart-shaped herb, and they had stealth technology built into their suits.
Right.
So it was like, also, if you pay attention, there's a scene where Shuri's like showing T'Challa all the new technology that she's been developing. And I think that in the back, there is the Hatut Zarazi costume that's hanging. And basically, I don't know if they're injecting vibranium or injecting the stealth technology into the weave. So it's like,
see that.
Yeah, it was crazy because I caught it on the time I went to go see it today. So right before we had the podcast, I went to go see Black Panther again. So it's like, I saw it in the back, and I was like, what is that? I was like, I didn't notice that before, and I think that's the suit. That's so awesome. That's pretty dope. But back to Nakia.
Sure.
Yeah. So Nakia is like, she represents this school of thought that says, we need to be more conscious contributors to the world around us. The my brother's keeper type of mindset. She realizes the power and potency that Wakanda has, and its poignancy in today's world, and how important it is in today's world. And she says, I want to do more. I want to help people. I want to be able to take people who are suffering and help them, you know what I'm saying, and contribute to the world as a whole. And she wants to be more involved. She doesn't think Wakanda should be closed bordered. She doesn't think Wakanda should be basically fooling the world and saying that they're not technologically advanced. They can't accept refugees, and they make themselves look like a third world country. Like, that's the way that other nations see Wakanda. It's like, oh, you see it in the news reports that they put up in Black Panther. It was like, Wakanda, a third world country of sheep herders and da 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 da. Like, they say this all the time. And Nakia wants to rip that veil open and say, hey, let's contribute to the global community. Right. You know what I'm saying? And what I like about her is like, she has like a tenderness to her, but she's fierce. Like, she is a fierce warrior. Like, when she's laying these cats down in this movie, like, they, like, those hits look hard. Only person I seen hit that hard is like Black Widow.
Yes.
Yes, when Widow takes people out, I feel bad for them cats.
She only hit one dude in the face with a wrench. I mean, come on.
Yo, I literally just watched that scene. I said, whoa.
Yeah.
Wow. Because
there's a clunk right behind it and she bashes dude's jaw in with a wrench.
Ooh, ooh. It was rough.
Yeah, she don't, Widow don't play. Neither does Nakia for sure.
Yup. And it's like the whole time I watched Nakia on screen, I was like, yo, how dope would it be to see a movie with her and Black Widow doing some mission together? Oh my gosh, that would be so lit.
I'm telling you, they're talking about that. They are saying that
the women of Black Panther, I think it was women of Black Panther, are pushing Marvel to be like, we need the Avengers with all of the female heroes.
Oh my gosh, and that would be so good.
It would be pretty dope. I think they kind of have to wait, you know, get Captain Marvel out there, get the movie out there, you know, and you know, maybe at some point Sue Storm. You know, get these characters kind of integrated, and then you could really, really do it up and do it well.
Yeah,
But I would agree. Seeing those two together on the screen fighting together would really be pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, man. It's like the Kia, the way she carries herself in the film is like, you know, like she's like just this deadly rose. Like, she's beautiful, she's poised, but don't forget about them thorns, man. She'll get you. You know what I'm
she's
saying?
Not, makes it very clear that she's not Dora Milaje.
Right.
But she's still just as skilled as they all are when it comes down to it.
Yeah. Cause it's like, if you look at them, like if you look at the Dora Milaje, they're like the Spartans. They feel like very Spartan warrior-ish.
Yes.
And I know that the Dora Milaje are actually based on an African tribe of women warriors. And that's how they developed that idea for the Dora Milaje. But like, if you look at the war dogs are basically the assassins. They're the ninjas. They're the covert agents. You know what I'm saying? So it's like Nakia can definitely handle herself, and you wouldn't even see it coming. And that's what I like about her character. But I like how tenderly she regards T'Challa. Like, even the way that she says his name is different than how everybody else says his name in the movie. If you pay attention, it's like she does like a pause and like an emphasis on his name. It's like T'Challa. It's like it's a pause as she says it. And I loved that part of that whole, like, of all her lingo, like, just the way that she would regard T'Challa with that tenderness. There's a respect there. There's a mutual respect that they have for each other. And T'Challa listens to Nakia. And I love that. Like,
well,
it's
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
It's more than a mutual respect. It's a love for each other. It's very clear.
Right. And it's like, I love that aspect of their relationship, that dynamic that they have, that tenderness that she has for him. She's loyal to him. Whereas Okoye is loyal to the throne, Nakia is loyal to T'Challa. He's been her king. He's been her prince or her king in waiting for a long time. And I'm sure he's been the quote unquote king of her heart forever. So it's like, you know, it just makes sense that their relationship dynamic is, I know that was cheesy, but whatever.
It's all good. Look, the passion you're giving to it, man, I'm just enjoying listening to it.
Yeah, man. I mean, I'm really enthralled by these characters. Like, and what Nakia represents, I think, is really potent and poignant. And it basically leads to where T'Challa ultimately ends up by the end of the film. You know what I'm saying? But yeah, I mean, I loved Nakia. She was definitely one of my favorite characters.
Her character's interesting to me because she's essentially exactly like the best friend, but on the opposite end of the spectrum.
Right.
She agrees that they're not doing enough for the rest of the world, but she's like, her opinion is, I don't want to take over the rest of the world. I want to lift the rest of the world up to where we are.
Yeah.
Like, that's really her ultimate goal, which is why, you know, he offers her, look, stay here, be my queen. You basically have the easiest life you could ever want. And she says, no, there's too much to do out there.
Yeah.
There's too much to help. There's so much we need to be doing, so much I can be doing better out there than I can do here with you.
Yeah.
You know, and it's that implied but unspoken, look, I want to be here with you 110%. There's no doubt about that. But I can't be with you and help to save the rest of the world at the same time. I just can't do that. So this is my path. This is what I want to do.
Yep.
And, you know, as the movie goes on and T'Challa starts to see how he's got that really twisted, not twisted. He's got that really hard line between wanting to stick to the culture, wanting to stick to the old ways that he was taught by his father, and understanding that, hey, we really can save the rest of the world. There's so much we can do to help save the rest of the world, and we're not doing any of it. Why are we not doing this? Yep. I understand the old ways say, this is what we have to be. We have to protect our people. But at the same time, I think even at one point, he even says, those are our people out in the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
We're all one people. You know, there's that first cutscene is basically that whole, his whole speech is basically saying that. We're all one people. We need to work together.
Right.
If we don't work together, we can't work together, we're never going to resolve these problems.
Yeah.
And he's got that real hard decision back and forth in the movie where he doesn't want to do it because it's not the old ways, but he wants to do it because he knows it's right.
Yep.
And like you just kind of said, I think she is that deciding factor for him. When it hits the end of the movie, he goes, you know what? She's absolutely right. She's got the right mind. We need to go out there and help the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And this is what we're going to do. We're going to do that.
Yep.
You know, even going so far as to tell his father, you were wrong.
Right.
We need...
Yeah.
We've not been doing things right for the entire existence of Wakanda, and that's going to change, essentially, is what he says to him. So,
yeah.
She is a keystone in the movie in that sense that she really is what helps him turn that corner to make that decision and change his mind.
Yeah.
And it's pretty impressive.
You know, yeah, it's dope.
She pulls that all off. And he's still, like you said, just a badass on the other end, you know, who could take out pretty much anybody, anywhere, anytime.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny though that you bring that up, like how T'Challa, like as you got into more detail about T'Challa, like basically making that decision and saying to his father that, hey, we need to change that, because you feel like T'Challa's biggest struggle in this entire film is like it's not about Eric Killmonger, it's not about protecting the vibranium. It's set up perfectly in his first visit to the astral plane to talk to his father. And it's he's struggling between being a good man and a good king.
Yep.
And there's a line in the film that T'Chaka uses. He said, you're a good man, you have a good heart, but a good man does not always make a good king.
Yep.
And that's the struggle that T'Challa is having, and I think that does a lot of setting up for where they could possibly go next, and where I think that they're going to go next, and we could talk about that later. But okay. I definitely feel like there is a Wakandan civil war on the way. So,
okay.
So we'll talk about that by the end of this. But let's dig into my next character, one of my favorite characters. I'll definitely say she's my favorite character in the film. I think that she stole the scenes that she was in. She definitely stole the scenes that she was in.
I would agree. And I know exactly who you're talking about.
Yeah, and that is Shuri, T'Challa's little sister. This woman, Letitia Wright, came in, took the role of Shuri, and crushes it. Every film, I feel like, every Marvel film has had that character where that one character steals the scenes that they're in. And,
yep.
and you could definitely say most recently with Thor Ragnarok, it was Korg. Korg was the one. Every scene that he was in, that guy stole him. You know what I'm saying? And Shuri is like that's in that same capacity. She's the brainiac. She's the one who's the one who makes all the designs for the technology that T'Challa is using, the remote, Kamoyo beads, the Kamoyo beads themselves, the communicators, just the diversity, like the variety that this technology can take on, like a Kamoyo beads as communicators and just like smartphone devices type thing. Like, yo, that technology in and of itself is incredible.
Oh, it was amazing.
Yeah, that was crazy. I love that. Black Panther's new costume in this movie, how it all sits in that necklace that he wears. Yep. Oh man, I was loving that. And then there's just like the impact of the kinetic energy absorption that the suit has now. It's like, oh, it's just the way that she does everything. Like one of my favorite quotes that she has is like, brother, it's like, I told you, it's like, just because something works fine doesn't mean that it can't be upgraded. You know what I'm saying? Doesn't mean that it can't be updated, that it can't be improved. You know what I'm saying? And it's just like that mindset that, you know, you never stop learning, you never stop growing. Like, everything needs to be improved. You can keep improving things and making them better. It's like, you know, you always worry about the opposite side of that Tony Stark, like, upgrading and improving for the sake of improving. You know what I'm saying? And it got to a point where it kind of deteriorated his mental state. But like Shuri kind of wears it as a way to say things can always be better. Things can always be improved, fine-tuned, and made to more appropriately handle the situation that it's addressing. You know what I'm saying?
Don't settle.
So yeah, I like the way that the suit fits on him a lot better too now with that upgrade. I think it fits a lot better. Like I felt like it was a little bulky in Civil War. And it's funny, though, because that was the suit that he designed, you know.
Right.
And then Shuri gives him the update and says, it's like, oh, and she pokes fun at him and says, like, oh, they're shooting at me. Wait, let me put on my helmet. It's like, yo, she just would not let my man live.
Not at all.
And I love that dynamic, like that brother and sister relationship that they had. It was so real. It felt real on screen. I want to say, like, just her comedic lines, just for me, they weren't overwhelming, but they did enough to hit hard, and then you move on to the next thing. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? And it's like,
quick,
I'm sure,
hits.
Yeah, like these real little quick hits, like even when she like cracks on his shoes and gives him the new ones, and then she cracks another joke before moving on to the next tech joint. It's like, it was good. It was so good. Like, she, for me, represents a school of thought within Wakanda that technology is what makes Wakanda great. Like, that's always going to be their main source. The downside is, and M'Baku has a line that he makes a commentary on Shuri, basically saying that, you know, you, all your technological advancements are run by a little girl who has no respect for tradition. And so it's like, you have to juggle that. Like, she lives in a world where, you know, in technology and science, like, things need to be proven and seen. And like, you watch her character kind of shift throughout the story, where she starts to understand, like, there are certain things that science will not explain. There are certain things that science cannot fix for her.
Yep.
And sometimes this level, this layer of magic, this layer of mysticism that's in that world of Wakanda is what they use to get through, you know?
Go ahead.
I was just like, no, I just really liked that learning process that she had, but her understanding that, you know, her understanding that technology overall had to be shifted, you know what I'm saying? Because I think if they're building her into wherever, even if they're setting her up to be Black Panther eventually, because that's how it was in the comics.
Right.
She has to have a better appreciation for the world around her and not just define it in terms of science and what can be proven. You know,
she's a brilliant, brilliant scientist, mm-hmm. but she's still a little girl.
Right.
Is really what comes out in the long run. Like, she doesn't really understand anything outside of her lab as far as the world is run, and she does it very well. She brings that feeling across very well in the movie. So
yeah,
it's interesting to kind of see that, you know, she could solve any problem with mm-hmm. her science in no time, but she doesn't understand that that's not always going to be the way things should be done.
Right, right.
You know, in her mind, it's, well, this works. Why not? And it's both because this is not how it's done. She doesn't quite get that, and I think she pulls that off really, really well.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, I'm going to say right now, I said it first here,
yep,
that she's going to be Ironheart, and the gauntlets at the end of the movie now have all these other people writing these articles saying she's going to be the next Ironheart. No, I said it first.
The professor said it first, y'all.
I want my credit. I said it first. When it happens, I'm not getting credit from anybody but you, but when it happens, I said it first.
Don't worry, I'll keep him honest.
I appreciate it. But she is a great character. Obviously, you know, she's important because she's the king's sister. You know, she's the princess at this point, essentially. But she's the most fun character in the entire movie at the same time.
Yeah.
Because she's goofy and she is young, so she's got that bright outlook on the world that, you know, you don't see in a lot of young kids these days.
Right, right.
God, this makes me sound old to say it, but it's true.
You know, we up there, man.
Yeah, no doubt. Shut up. You up there? You ain't even 30 yet.
I am. I'm past that. Yeah, I'm 30. I'm 31.
Oh, that's what you are.
Man, I'm old, wrong, dog.
You know what? I'm going to let that one slide and keep moving. But it's just, you know, she's still got that, like her you would have to imagine her favorite part of the entire movie as the character is when she's showing him the kinetic setup on his suit, mm-hmm. and he kicks it across the lab and starts yelling at him about breaking everything. And she pulls the phone out and he's like, "Why are you recording? Just do it again. It's just, you know, for science." And he kicks it and flies across the room. And the first thing he said, "Delete that video before he even gets off the ground."
Cause he knows
what she's doing. So she's a fun character, man. She's a cool character, but she's also a badass in her own right. Like, she doesn't back down from Killmonger, who very clearly has her outmatched, you know, from the jump. But she doesn't back down. She goes right at him.
Yep.
You know, and is fearless when it comes down to it. So
she's
definitely one of the more fun characters in the movie. And a lot of people did say she stole the movie. I don't disagree. She definitely stole the scenes that she was in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be interested to see if they do more with her as the next movies come on, like give her more of a lead role than kind of what she had in this one.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm definitely leaning towards your theory that she might be headed towards being Ironheart. And it just makes sense because I don't feel like they're set, like, even though, you know, Peter and Tony have this relationship.
Oh, yeah.
In Homecoming. And it seems like he's mentoring him. I just don't see Spider-Man taking that capacity as far as being the next. He might be the next Tony Stark. I just don't see him being the next Iron Man. You know what I'm saying?
It just doesn't fit the Peter Parker character to be the next Iron Man. It really doesn't.
Right. So it's just like, for me, it's like, I'd be interested to see if that's what they do with Shuri's character, because like everybody knows who's a comic book fan knows that Shuri eventually becomes Black Panther. She basically leads Wakanda because T'Challa steps down and he takes a more active role in the Avengers. The fact that she's like 17, 18 in this movie leads me to believe it's going to be a long time before we see Shuri take the mantle of Black Panther. Yeah. And I feel like Chadwick's going to be in it for a long time. So it's like, if you really want to push the envelope, if you really want to, you know, instead of having to introduce a new character, you can use Shuri to as a surrogate to be that Ironheart character. I mean, for all intents and purposes, the brilliance that she has and her you know, her pursuing of technology puts her in the same boat as Riri Williams for all intents and purposes.
Oh, yeah. They're very very similar characters.
Yeah. So it just would make sense if they did it, that way. So I could definitely vibe with that, because I mean, look, folks, this is not spoiler. This is just conjecture. I just don't see Tony making it past Infinity War, man. I don't know.
Maybe not. That dude, it's so tough to determine that.
Right. It is.
Because I've given my thought before. I'm pretty sure Pepper dies, but that could be. I think Pepper dies in the movie. I think the scene where they show Thanos punching somebody in the Iron Man suit, I think that's Pepper in the suit.
Damn.
And I think she ends up dying. And I think when you see him and he's on his knees and he's holding something up towards his chest, almost up towards his face, you know, you hear Peter say, "Tony, I'm so sorry." I think that's Pepper on the ground. I think he's holding her hand. And I think she's dead.
Wow.
And I think ultimately that leads to him not being Iron Man anymore because he couldn't protect her.
Yeah.
So I think that's what quote unquote kills Tony Stark, I think, is maybe what happens.
Yeah.
But I think it sets up perfectly to have her step into that spot because look, you've already seen her with repulsor rays essentially.
Yeah, so basically.
She's gonna be familiar with that, right? You know, the next step is just a full suit of armor and flying around. And I could see it making sense. I could see them doing that.
Yeah, yeah. Last character I want to talk about. I feel like we talked about M'Baku a little bit. We talked about the Queen Mother, Ramonda. They don't have like a lot of lines within the movie, but we definitely appreciated them as we were telling this other story of characters. But the last character I really wanted to explore was Killmonger.
Yeah.
Probably, I would go as far as to say he's probably one of the MCU's best villains
They've
created. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
As far as complexity and the dynamic between him and the protagonist and just his ultimate origin story blending into the person that he became. It's like, you know, I feel like when you talk about Marvel characters, traditionally, I feel like their villains have always been sort of, you know, one dimensional in the comic books. I mean, you always have your diamonds, you have your Doctor Dooms, and you have your other complicated villains. Like even Loki, I think in the comics was pretty complicated. And then Spider-Man's villains always had some kind of duality. For the most part, everybody's been worried about Marvel villains. They've been pretty much disposable. Until recently, we got Loki, who's become much more of a complex character,
right?
Who's taken on a life of his own. I feel like this universe, they consider this Marvel Cinematic Universe. What do they consider this? Earth. It's not Earth 616. It's like Earth 9999 something or something.
Something like that. Yeah, I don't know exactly.
Yeah, at least in this Earth, I think he's different than he's ever been in any incantation of Loki, I feel like. And it's been great for the franchise. Killmonger is definitely one of those characters where his complexity leads you to believe that he's not a complete villain. Like I was leaning more towards Killmonger a few times in this movie than I felt like normally I would have for any other villain. You know what I'm saying? I was on his side. You know what I'm saying? It's weird the way that it went down because he has a lot of powerful and potent lines in the film that make you really think about things. And he represents this body of thought for me, within and without Wakanda, that has this mindset of just the feeling of abandonment. You know what I'm saying? Especially when you're talking about it in the realms of being an African American in this country, like this feeling of like lost heritage, this lost history, trying to find out what culture you belong to, trying to develop your own culture, and just like the feeling of isolation. And basically, he knows he can go. He knows he has a home, but his home won't even come get him. His home wouldn't even look after him. And he was tossed to the wayside by a place his father respected and called home. You know what I'm saying? And so you're watching this character develop through the film, and this bitterness is being developed in his personality, and you're seeing how ruthless he is to achieve his mission. He's trying to get to Wakanda, and he's trying to take the throne. You know what I'm saying? He will do it by any means. You know what I'm saying? If you look at the T'Challa and Nakia character as kind of like the Martin Luther King school of thought within Black Panther, then you can argue that Killmonger is along the borderline of the militant, like the Malcolm X, by any means necessary. You take something from me, I'm taking something from you type of school of thought. And it's like that school of thought is like you can't villainize it, but you can understand it. You know what I'm saying? It's like right. Sometimes through that movie, I'm like, it's like, dang, man, I really want to hate your guts as a villain. Like, you're the bad guy, man, but I can't hate you. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, it was really, he had some really powerful moments, some really powerful quotes, and like him being a foil to T'Challa to make him, it was basically, he was the one, the fulcrum that made T'Challa question how, like, his country. It made him question the way that government had been enacted before. So it's like, the question now is like, yo, this is a demon that my father created. This is something that came up because of a misaction of my country.
Yep.
And it's like, how can I really be opposed to this man when he's just trying to figure out where he fits in? Now, eventually it gets to a point for Killmonger, and Okoye notices this, where he's just completely on a self-destructive path. Like, now it's past like you trying to prove a point. Now everybody has to burn because you're hurting.
Right.
And that's a problem. Yep. You know what I'm saying? And that's what makes him the villain by the end of the film. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, but just listening to him, you know, he has this really intense moment, really heavy moment with T'Challa in the last scenes, and he's sitting there. He's like, you know, my father wanted me. He said the sunsets in Wakanda were beautiful. He always wanted me to come here. And so T'Challa takes him out so that he can see the sunset over Wakanda.
Yep.
And he's like sitting there trying to figure things out. And T'Challa's like, we can save you. But he's like, no. So you can lock me up so I can be bound and caged again. He was like, no, just throw me out in the ocean with my ancestors that knew that they'd rather die than to be bound. And it's like, yo, it's like, it was so, if I could tell you the feeling that was in that theater when that line was said, I heard so many. It was like, it was heavy. It was so heavy.
It was a heavy line, man. It was good. It was really good.
It was really good. And it's like, yo, it's a testament to the acting ability of Michael B. Jordan. You know what I'm saying? This is what happens when you give a talented actor a worthwhile role in a superhero film. You know what I'm saying? I'm telling you, because he got that opportunity and he pushed it to the limit for Fantastic Four, but it couldn't make anything for those characters or that story. I feel like that story fell apart halfway through. And it was so bad because they did a good job of setting up the characters and making you feel involved with these characters. And then they just completely throw it out the window at the end. You can tell at what point, because Josh Trank, he directed Fantastic Four, right?
Yep.
Yeah. You can tell when Trank actually lost control of the movie.
Yeah.
You could tell when the production company said, okay, we're going to make the rest of the film. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, it's rough. It's rough. But like, now he's showing you his acting chops, and he's showing you his ability to play like a dark character with some variety. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's complex, his character. So you don't truly hate him. But you know that you know that something has to change with his character.
Right.
You know? So it's like, you know, we get to the end of the film, and it's just like, yo, Killmonger's effects on Wakanda are definitely going to spill over into the sequel. I know it. And it's like, the way that they set it up, like, you have all of these different schools of thought that we've been experiencing, and all these diverse ideas about where Wakanda should go. It's going to cause some rifts. It's going to draw some lines in the sand. Especially with the character Wakabi, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a civil war in Wakanda. Like, basically the latest issues of Black Panther have been exploring that. A Nation Under Our Feet explores Wakanda post-traumatic destruction. Like, after Namor destroys Wakanda, you know, they're still trying to figure out whether or not T'Challa is all about them, and whether or not he's a worthy king to look after the needs of Wakanda. Like, the Black Panther's mission is to be the Wakanda's protector, and T'Challa fails that, and so the angst rises in his country. So we've already seen in the Infinity War trailer that there is going to be that type of cataclysmic event happening in Wakanda when Thanos comes. Right. So I feel like Thanos is basically going to serve like Namor, where he destroys Wakanda. And this is going to cast a lot of doubt on whether or not T'Challa's new stance on becoming part of the global community was the best decision for Wakanda.
Yeah.
So, you know what I'm saying? So it'll be interesting to see where Black Panther goes from this. I really like Killmonger. I really like Killmonger as a character. I kind of hope that he comes back and would be like a redeemable character like Loki, and be somebody to T'Challa like Wakabi was,
right?
And be his second in command and run his police force, even running the watchdogs. Like, I could see Killmonger running the watchdogs, you know what I'm saying, and having these spies in place over different parts of the globe to make sure that everybody is protected and safe and things like that. You know what I'm saying? Like, it would be basically what he wanted from the jump. You know what I'm saying? So, and the beauty of it is the way that the story was told, they fought with the heart-shaped herb. So, you know what I'm saying? I wouldn't be surprised if we see Killmonger come back, but if not, I mean, it is what it is. I think that would be a loss. That would definitely be a great loss to their story. But
I would agree with you there for sure.
Yeah, but I think that it would be in their best interest though to bring him back.
He's definitely the most relatable and understandable villain that they've had in any of these movies so far. You know, every other movie more or less has got somebody who's trying to take over the world to dominate the rest of the world. He's not quite where he kind of gets like that to the end of the movie. The majority of him in the movie is not that way at all. The majority of the way of the movie is, this is my birthright, I've come to take it back. And that's essentially what he's really all about when it comes down to it. So it's difficult, like you said, it's difficult to not be on his side for parts of the movie because of that. Because you do feel that struggle, especially when, you know, he goes to see his father. And they have that whole scene with him, you know, speaking with his father in the afterlife. And it's not in, you know, the plains of
Wakanda.
Or there's a special name for it that they call it, the Fields of Something. I forget exactly what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
But
I can't think of it.
He's in the apartment where his father died. You know, so it's just a whole different feel behind everything, you know, and I was never really a big Michael B. Jordan fan. I liked him in Creed. I wasn't the biggest fan of some of the other stuff I've seen him in. I am kind of a fan now because his performance in this movie is just fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, like my ultimate favorite villain as far as the movies so far has always been Loki. I think Tom Hiddleston walked off the page of the Thor comics to become Loki.
Yeah.
Killmonger is right there with him as far as being the best villain in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I agree that it would be a shame to not bring him back in some fashion, have him available in some way. I don't think it's going to happen, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I could see how they would do it, like you said, because he's got the herb in him and he's still got the powers of the Black Panther, so he could have some kind of healing regenerative ability. I just don't know that they would do that.
Yeah.
But it's a shame because it is an excellent, excellent character to have to lose.
Yeah. In the long run, yeah. So. Cause like what I've definitely have to step back and realize is that they're telling these stories in a different format now. So it's like we're not reading comic book pages anymore. So whereas stories can go on for ages and ages, and we can also bring back characters who we thought were dead because it just works for the storytelling. For a movie cinematic universe, we know that there is a finite time. Like, things are gonna run up. Like, how many issues did we get before we got an Infinity War? And so it's appropriate that now we're here. It's at film. We're getting to film 22. It's 10 years Marvel's been doing this. It's appropriate that they should be coming up to a bad, big bad that's this heavy in a cataclysmic event that's this hard at this point in the game. It's just like when you're dealing with cinematic universes, time travels faster. So it's like you don't get to nobody gets a one up. Nobody gets a second life. You know what I'm saying? Right. It's like when you die, you die. That's it. You know what I'm saying? Unless you're Phil Coulson, but you know.
Yeah. So, all right. So let's do some closing thoughts on this then,
because we're just over an hour at this point. I think we kind of covered all the characters and everything we were talking about. So, I'll give mine, then I'll allow you to have the last word here.
All right, Ben.
So, Chris Pratt, actually, I was just kind of poking around some things while we were talking, and and he put a tweet up that I think his explanation of the movie is perfect.
Right.
He said, it's like a Bond movie meets a Shakespearean tragedy.
Oh, wow.
And I think that's an excellent, excellent way to put it, because it really is very much like that. It's very much a high-tech spy movie that just has all that feeling of a family gone wrong that Shakespeare novels would have. I think it really is. You know, Coogler, I only know Coogler from Creed and from this at this point. I'm not sure what else he's done, if he's done much.
Oh, you got to check out Fruitvale Station. Check out Fruitvale Station if you ever get a chance. Yeah.
Okay. But it's clear that this guy is amazing at what he does. You know, and look, Creed is an excellent movie. Is it one of the top greatest movies of all time? No, but it's an excellent, excellent movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a new direction for Rocky, for a Rocky movie, so to speak, and just really, really well done to tell that story.
Yeah.
Then you come to this story, and he just crushes it. Like, this is, it's, again, like I said before, I have to see it again to determine where I'm going to put it in my Marvel pantheon. My initial personal feeling is it wasn't better than Winter Soldier, but like we talked about offline, Winter Soldier to me is a near perfect movie.
Yeah.
So beating that at this point, it's probably going to take an Infinity War. We'll see.
Yeah.
But I did very much enjoy this movie, and I'm sorry I didn't get to see it again because I really, really wanted to. But look, if you're on the fence and you're not sure, it's undoubtedly a movie you should go see in the theater right now.
Yeah,
3D doesn't matter necessarily. Just go see it. You know, it's if you have somebody who's even on the fence about being a comic book movie fan, you don't have to be a comic book movie fan to go see this. It doesn't rely on the other movies to make its point and tell its story.
Yeah,
you know, it's just fine the way it is, and anybody can follow it from start to finish. So, absolutely, you know, as far as I'm concerned, and I'm sure the sentiment is going to be echoed. Go see it, you know, more than once if you can, if you do that with movies, because it's just that good.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I'm gonna definitely agree with you. Like, this is a must see film. It's powerful, it's potent. The themes, the thoughts that are expressed in this film are incredible. Ryan Coogler does it again. This is this man's third film. His third film. And every one of his films have been critically acclaimed. You know what I'm saying? Like, even Creed got Sylvester Stallone. Did he get an Oscar or a nom for that?
He might have gotten a nom. I don't think he got the Oscar, but he might have
gotten a nom. Yeah, he got a nom for that. When's the last time we heard Sylvester Stallone getting a nom for anything?
It's an excellent point.
So it speaks to the quality of director when he can bring out performances from actors like this. And I'm not surprised at all that Michael B. Jordan has this partnership with Coogler. So, you know, whenever these guys team up, you know it's going to be good. And Jordan knows, like, Coogler tells stories the way, like, that have a hard impact on the culture, on people, you know what I'm saying? And that's what I think is a strength to this film. It's definitely my favorite film. And now I say this because I talked to the professor about this before, but it's my favorite alongside Captain America Winter Soldier. Now, Captain America Winter Soldier will always be one of Marvel's greatest achievements because it solidified the superhero genre.
Yep.
It's like, I don't care. Anybody can battle me on this. They can tell me that this is not the case. But the reason that we're talking about Logan getting an Oscar nomination is because Captain America Winter Soldier took the superhero genre to a point where it was going to be critically received. It took it to a point where it's going to be critically respected. You know what I'm saying? The themes and story that Winter Soldier told and what it built on was incredible. I mean, Captain America Winter Soldier speaks to me as very generally as an American in this country. We have these questions of government trust. Can we trust the government? We have these themes of how do we treat our veterans when they come home after serving this country for as many tours as they serve. You know what I'm saying? All these questions and all these doubts of who we can trust, all absolute power corrupting absolutely, and a man just simply trying to find his place in a world that's forgotten about him. You know what I'm saying? And it's just like it, the way that they tell this just spy political thriller is just incredible. You know what I'm saying? Black Panther speaks to me very specifically as a black man in this country. You know what I'm saying? I identify with every character in Black Panther. Killmonger as an African American in this country trying to find my past, find my roots, what culture can I connect to? The feeling of pride and seeing my people on screen and seeing them on screen well and seeing what I identify with as my historic culture being represented in a very fictional story, but it's still real. It's still real. And the ability of that movie to have everybody in that audience feel a part of that family is a testament to its storytelling, a testament to its execution. You know what I'm saying? So for me, like, Black Panther is worth seeing. It's worth seeing in the best way that you can see it. 3D is not really necessary. I don't think 3D has been necessary for me for a while. Guardians of the Galaxy is something you want to see in 3D. But Black Panther, see that in IMAX. Like, watch these colors pop out at you. You know what I'm saying? See these grand landscapes unfold in front of you. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's worth that type of view. I've already seen it 3 times, and I told y'all before, like, I'm seeing it every day while it's still in theaters. and trust and believe I'm gonna do it.
Oh, I believe it. I believe
You know what I'm saying? So it's like, yo, this movie hits hard in the lines that it delivers and the themes that it places out there. The description of it being a spy, a James Bond movie mixed with a Shakespearean tragedy is like, it's I feel that, you know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. that's really what it is, because you see these intricate government structures, you see almost the collapsing of a government, of a monarchy, and you watch it rise from the ashes. But then you have this whole international aspect with high technology and infiltrating you know, general audiences and things like that. Like, just all those spy aspects, you know what I'm saying, encompassed around this royal family drama. You know what I'm saying? It just, it's so much to pull from this story. And it does a really good job at letting everybody know that you too are Wakandan. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's this scene by the end of the film where Everett Ross, it's like a small character in that film, but like, yo, let's talk about how epic Everett Ross was, because he stood behind, like, he really just stood behind T'Challa regardless. He didn't really even care. Like, this man didn't have no loyalties to Wakanda, and he stays and fights for this country that's not his own. You know what I'm saying? And he has this whole scene where he's flying this plane and he gets caught up and they have him restrained and he can't get out. And so he's like, how do I get out, Shuri? And Shuri tells him, like, you have to cross your arms in an X and then release it. It's basically that's the Wakandan gesture. That's the Wakanda forever gesture.
Right.
And he puts his hands in that X, and then she says, release it. And he releases it. And then it's just like, there's this moment of pause, and then he gains control of the plane, and he does what he needs to do and takes out that last plane. It was like, in that moment, it was like the movie was saying, we're all Wakandan. And it was like, it was beautiful to me. Like, and that's the stuff that I feel like masterpiece movies are made of. You know what I'm saying? Which is why this is going to be my favorite film for a long time. You know what I'm saying?
Until Black Panther 2.
I'm telling you, till Black Panther 2 come out. You know what I'm saying? Then I'll be talking about Black Panther 2.
That's right.
Oh, man. But I feel like this is creating the same moment that Captain America Winter Soldier did. It's like where Captain America makes a film and makes a superhero film and says, hey, this film is legit. This film is worth watching and worth praising. We're saying that it's a good film. It's worthy of awards. You know what I'm saying? Black Panther does the same thing and says, yo, look at this. This is a movie about the culture of an African hero. This is a movie with a majority black cast that can sell box office numbers, not just domestically, but internationally. And I feel like the story has always been for film. Like, and I mean, they said this Gods of Egypt, they said this in Egypt's God, Kings and Men or something like Gods and Kings or something like that.
Right.
Why aren't black actors casted in some of these roles? And the excuse always is, well, you know, internationally, you know, a black leading cast doesn't sell well overseas. Well, Black Panther just shot all of that to pieces. So
certainly did.
You know what I'm saying? It's like, it's no more. This is why this movie is monumental. This movie is monumental for a new reason, because it shattered expectations. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, this is one of those movies that like people are going to be talking about for years to come. And it's because of how potent it is, how relevant it is. And just how meaningful it is, how thoughtful Coogler was in his storytelling on this one. So it was a well-rounded movie for me, man. And I'm definitely telling you guys, go see it. So there it is.
Look, you're not going to get a better view than that, people. I mean, look, you're not going to get anybody with more passion, you know, for this movie. Talking about that. So. From the professor and from the boss, definitely go see this movie. You won't regret it.
Yeah, man.
So I think that will do it for us here today at the boss's desk. If you are tuned in for the first time, thank you very much. Don't forget to follow us on the various social media outlets. We do have Facebook under the boss's desk, on Twitter at the boss's desk, and we have our own YouTube channel on the boss's desk as well. Do you have any questions about anything you heard in today's pod, or you want to give us your opinions on Black Panther, or questions or things you know you were curious about, you can send us an email at questions@thebossesdesk.com. You can drop us a tweet at the boss's desk. You know, and if you know we get that, we can maybe send a little shout out next week when we get back to kind of our regular format and answer those questions for you. But you know, for now, that's it from the boss. That's it from the professor. Thanks for tuning in. Catch you all next week. We're out.
Peace.
That's it. Wakanda forever.
Wakanda forever.